So my job is to summarise the contents of the report. I'm assuming you've all studied it very carefully, so I will be fairly brief in summarising the contents. And I should also acknowledge that in addition to our distinguished chairman, Lord Selborne, there are several other members of the Select Committee here tonight, so they may wince if I misrepresent their conclusions, but I hope I don't. Let me start with sort of definitions, and I did check in Webster's Dictionary online what procurement meant, and I was disturbed to find that it could mean either, and I quote, obtain by particular care and effort, which I think is what we mean, or alternatively get and make available for promiscuous sexual intercourse, which we are not talking about. So it's how the government obtains goods and services by particular care and effort. And by innovation, we mean the, and we define it in the report, and I will just encapsulate briefly, the stimulation and exploitation of new ideas, which could be the novel application of an existing idea. It could be a brand new idea applied to a process, a product, or a system. Or another form of innovation would be intelligent plagiarism, taking an idea from that's already been implemented elsewhere, for example, the Oyster card in London, and implementing it here. So those are the definitions. The facts are, as Lord Selborne has already mentioned, that the government spends, or in the last estimate, was £236 billion in a year on procurement of goods and services. That's government including local government and agencies. That's about 1/7 of GDP, so it's a very significant chunk of money, and clearly the government in this broad sense is the largest single customer in the country for goods and services. So the question was, does the government, where appropriate, use its purchasing muscle to drive innovation? And if it doesn't, what might be done to make the situation better? Well, you might start by saying, well, what should the government be driving innovation? Is there any advantage? Is it the role of government to do so? And the evidence we heard was that there could be at least two reasons for the government using its procurement muscle to drive innovation. One is the immediate reason to gain better solutions for the public sector, for public services and public products. And the second is to stimulate innovative industries to develop products and services for the government, which may then have a market elsewhere and thereby stimulate economic growth. So it's a parallel. Those are not alternatives. They could operate in parallel. And a third point to emphasise is that we didn't see innovation as an alternative to obtaining value for money, because you could obtain, in some cases, better value for money by going for a novel solution rather than the tried and tested. Now, we are not the first group to look at this. For example, in 2009, the House of Commons Business and Enterprise Committee and the National Audit Office looked at government procurement and innovation, and they both, on the scorecard, gave the government something considerably below an alpha. Not uniform across the piece, but overall, the government could do much better. And both reports emphasise that a lot of procurement goes for routine solutions where a more innovative solution might have provided better value for money and a better outcome for the population of the country. And we found from the evidence that we heard, just to summarise in a way the bottom line, that all too often tried and tested is the default option where it might not be the best default option. Now, as is characteristic for this country, there is no shortage of analysis. There are reports going back over the past few years, and I'll just list five of them. 2007, Transforming Government Procurement. 2007, David Sainsbury's report, Race to the Top. 2008, Innovation Nation White Paper. 2010, The Path to Strong, Sustainable and Balanced Growth. 2010, Technology Blueprint. So there are reports that say, yes, the government should be using its procurement muscle inter alia for stimulating innovation and seeking better solutions to public problems and public services. So there's no shortage of analysis. And there have been, to be fair, over the last few years, certain special initiatives started up to particularly develop innovation. And I just mentioned the three main ones, the Small Business Research Initiative, SBRI, the Technology Strategy Board, and the Forward Commitment Procurement. But between them, those account for a tiny fraction, a fraction of 1% of the total procurement budget. So those particular initiatives may be, and some of them doing good work, and we believe they are, although early days, but the real question is not to park innovation in these special tiny little car parks out on the left wing, but to embed it more systemically into the mainstream of procurement thinking. And we heard no convincing evidence that all these reports, all this analysis, beautifully written reports, have led to a systematic and coherent change in the approach to procurement and innovation. And we conclude, as indeed others have done, that there's a deep-seated cultural problem, which is partly about risk aversion. And I was talking to David just before the session started about his experience in government service on, you know, ministers saying, for God's sake, don't try a risky solution, go for something safe. So a culture of risk aversion, but also a lack of know-how, understanding what an innovative solution would look like if you met it on a dark night, or indeed if it was served up with watercress around it. So who is actually in charge? The answer is there is no one person in government in charge of innovation and procurement, but there are a number of key players. The Cabinet Office, with Frances Maud as the lead minister, leads on procurement policy, whereas BIS leads on innovation policy. And within the Cabinet Office, the relatively newly formed Efficiency Reform Group, and I think Sally will tell us more about that, has a role in streamlining government procurement processes. And then finally, individual departments make their own decisions about procurement within the overall policy framework. So one of our recommendations is that there should be a minister who has responsibility or accountability overall for innovation and procurement across government, and that within each department there should be a minister with departmental accountability. Now, we looked at one department in particular, Department for Transport, as we considered various options, and we decided to look at DFT, partly because they have some major procurement initiatives coming up, and they have major executive agencies such as the Highways Agency that undertake substantial procurement. Like most departments, perhaps all departments, DFT has an innovation procurement plan. But when you look at it, it describes what's going on, but it doesn't really have measurable objectives, outcomes, and timescales. So one thing we think should happen, and recommendation, is that these IPPs, innovation procurement plan, should become a little bit sharper and not purely descriptive. A second important point within departments is the role of chief scientific advisors. Now, many departments have got independent chief scientific advisors, and we're going to hear shortly from Brian Collins, who gave evidence for us as a CSA in the Department for Transport. I should just say parenthetically that there's some sort of slight risk that the government is going backwards in this area. For example, they did a trumpet recently, the announcement of a chief scientific advisor in the Treasury, but it's not an independent outside expert, as those of us who favour the scheme of outside advice speaking truth to power, it's a career civil servant with several other day jobs. But the CSAs in departments should have a prominent role, a more prominent role in innovation and procurement, and their prominent role should include helping the departments with horizon scanning for long-term issues and acting as an intelligent customer, which means knowing what is going on out there and knowing how to judge what are plausible options. And we did hear one extremely good example, which I will just trail that Brian was a star, but he will tell you more about it, in his knowledge of research going on sponsored by EPSERC and how that could be brought in to the procurement process and actually implemented in the transport sector. And I won't steal his thunder, just to say that it was, for us, an outstanding example of what CSAs could do if they had a central role in innovation and procurement. On the time horizon and sort of looking at long-term issues, we were concerned when Transport for London in their evidence said, for us, a long-term time horizon is 20 years. Now, given that they're building infrastructure that's going to be around, if the track record is anything to go by, probably for 100 years, and, for instance, the climate is going to change in that 100-year time frame, we were concerned about that, so we wrote to them for clarification, and they said, oh, no, we do take into account longer time horizons, but the mere fact that two people from the same organisation gave contradictory answers indicates that it's not mainstream in the organisation, not front of mind, or it may indicate that. So that's the role of CSAs in being an intelligent customer, helping the department with that and helping them to time horizon to scan the long-term time horizon. Then we come back to this issue of playing safe and risk aversion. And although we don't provide a specific solution for the government, we do challenge them to come up with ways of thinking about how to incentivize amongst civil servants the relative or the appropriate level of risk taking and, importantly, risk management. Because there's no point in taking a punt if you don't have a way of understanding whether the punt is going to go wrong and therefore expose the public sector to undue risk. So those are some of the key recommendations. I just want to talk briefly about the specific initiatives, the SBRI, the TSB, and the Forward Commitment Procurement. We were given some success stories, but they seem to be, at this stage, either modest or very early stage. So the Forward Commitment Procurement has produced, you'll be excited to know, recyclable mattresses and pillows for HM Prison Service, as an example of innovative procurement. Well, it's good, but it's pretty small beer. And what was called biodynamic lighting for the Rotherham NHS Trust. And I'd be interested to see it. I haven't yet made a trip to Rotherham to understand what biodynamic lighting is. The SBRI, which is still in a sort of embryonic stage in terms of bringing things through to completion, identified two particular examples. One was a potential traffic flow modelling system, and the other was a system for securing mobile phones. So there are some glimmers there of things that may come through, but as I emphasised, these are very small fractions of the total procurement effort, and the issue is how we mainstream thinking about innovation, at least recognising that it could be, in some cases, the right way to go. Now, I want to just mention three other things. One is that there are some larger scale good examples, and the Highways Agency gave us some rather good evidence, and you were all familiar with the variable speed limit controls that operate around the M25, which was an example of coming up with an innovative answer to a problem of traffic management, and that seemed to be something that the Highways Agency had led on the development of, and then they've being able to sell the idea overseas. So that's one point. There are some good points, good highlights, but it's not uniform. The second in my last three points that I want to make is that the issue of localism could well exacerbate the problem, because we heard from Frances Maud what we thought was perhaps an overly optimistic view about how local authorities would be able to innovate in their own area. Now, given what I've said about the need for an intelligent customer role to understand the links with what's going on out there in the science base and in industries that are technology-driven, we were not convinced that local authorities on their own as relatively small entities would have the capacity to drive innovation and procurement at the local level. So we think that's something to flag up to watch for the future. And my final comment, which may anticipate some of the things that Sally says, we were very encouraged to hear that attempts are being made to streamline the procurement process so that people aren't put off. I mean, if it's a very complicated process with vast forms to fill in, then small companies won't have the time and the resource to put into into bidding. And so anything that can be done to streamline and make it more transparent and straightforward would be a positive step forward. Really all I want to say, and I look forward to hearing the comments from others and to hearing the discussion about our report. Oh, one final thing I should say is that we have said in the report that we will come back in about 18 months' time to look at whether anything has changed, recognising that with all these other reports, not much has changed, bits have changed, but not a hell of a lot. We're going to keep our eye on it and come back and see what's happening in another 18 months. Thank you very much.